Wait, I want to do this.
Wake up, it's time to start your day. No better way than rolling with David L. Gray. Wake up, it's praise and morning prayer. Then news and reflections with David L. Gray. And share. It's David L. Gray in the morning with joy in the air.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Let the spirit move you.
Good morning.
David L. Gray.
David
L. Gray in the morning.
Big in the morning.
Joy and
praise all the ways.
All the way.
And good morning, it's David L. Gray in the morning. Glad you're here. Hope I continue to bless your day. That's my goal. Coming up in about 15 minutes at the top of the hour, we're going to have the news headlines. And after that, we're going to have a commentary and reflections of the readings of Mass. But coming up now, immediately, right after the introduction, we will have today's top headlines. Get into some breaking news of the day. This is David L. Gray in the morning.
Hello, I am David L. Gray. I am a Catholic theologian. Writing and speaking and teaching courses you can find at stdominicsmedia.com. My work centers on liturgical theology, which is also the focus of my doctoral studies at the Catholic University of America. Welcome to my morning show. It's here where I'll walk you through the day's top stories, offer an uplifting reflection on the readings at Mass, and introduce you to the saints of the day. We're here every weekday at 6:45 a.m. If this show enriches your day, I hope you come back, and I look forward to connecting with you. Let's get into today's show.
We're beginning this morning with shocking news coming out of Minneapolis. A group of angry protesters stormed into a Protestant church during their worship service, clearly violating their religious freedom. Let's take a look.
We have a duty to win.
Justice for
our immigrant neighbor.
Justice for
our immigrant
neighbor.
What you just saw was, I think, really part of a larger pattern, right? Minneapolis has long been in a state of unrest for several days, with protests spreading across the city. In response to the city's, what ICE has been doing in the city, ICE shooting people shooting at ICE, the federal immigration crackdown. There have been numerous injuries, multiple arrests, and I think really just an untold amount of property damage. And tensions continue to escalate. Minneapolis has become, I think, the nation's city of protests. I mean, we saw this during the Black Lives Matter riots. It's like whenever these people who want to get us to worry about something or get people who don't use critical thinking skills to get their emotions all in a knot, they call in the city of Minneapolis. I mean, cue the outrage, cue the cameras, bust in the protesters, and let's make some money to create some power vacuums. And I find this really to just be a manufactured crisis. And I think here's where we need to step back. We're being told that this is some sort of unprecedented emergency. But the immigration enforcement has been grinding along for like decades. we see that the numbers that Trump is doing as far as deportation now do not even come close at some periods to what Obama was doing. Yeah, I think the process grinded under a halt, you know, priorities shifted during the presidency of Biden, but the deportations never stopped. So why is this a national crisis at the moment if the system has never changed dramatically? Why this city? Why this news cycle? I think Minneapolis has become a kind of national stage for the outrage politics, from police shootings to riots to now ICE raids and now church invasions. The city keeps getting chosen as the backdrop for the next great American crisis, because this is how manufactured crisis works. Real people suffer, but their suffering becomes really just raw material for those who want more power. The crisis is declared. Here's a formula. Crisis declared, emotions and rage, emergency measures are taken, National Guard come in, curfews, mobilizing the military, money's raised, and freedoms are quietly negotiated away. I think as Catholics, I think we can affirm clearly what the church teaches, that states do have a right of sovereignty. They can determine their own borders. They can determine who gets to be a citizen and who cannot. Fine, we agree on that as Catholics. That's what the church teaches, and I think it's just. At the same time, we can insist that every human person, including those who are here illegally, must be treated with dignity and justice. But that's not the conversation being had. This is an election year, and like so many other times, this moment is being shaped into a crisis because crises are politically profitable. So what's the question? I think the question for us, I think, is simple. Will we let our emotions be stirred by this news cycle? Or will it be reshaped as Catholics first and not as props in someone else's campaign? Another news, speaking about, you know, things circling back, I saw that NASA is preparing to send the first humans around the moon again. This is the first crewed lunar mission in, I think, 50 years.
The last time the Kennedy Space Center saw rockets rolled out to the launch pad for a crewed mission to the moon was half a century ago. Then it was the enormous Saturn V with the Apollo lander on top. Now it's the Space Launch System, the most powerful rocket ever built, topped with the Orion spacecraft, preparing not for a landing this time, but an interplanetary slingshot.
They will not even try to land on the moon. They will not even go into orbit around the moon, but they will shoot past the moon 5,000 miles, sort of do a U-turn, come back, and then splash down in the Pacific.
After an uncrewed test flight 3 years ago, the Artemis program is now in full swing with lofty goals. Get human feet back on the moon, on the far side where there might be accessible ice water, set up an orbiting lunar space station, and even build a permanent base on the surface. If all that goes well, who knows what could be next for the SLS rocket.
It's got that extra capability with potential to go further than the moon itself. So potentially to Mars, potentially to places like Jupiter. It has the potential to carry telescopes, for instance, into deep space for deep space observations, that kind of thing.
Your Artemis II crew.
Now it's time for final assembly and checks before three Americans and a Canadian hop aboard early next month and the next chapter of human spaceflight blasts off.
Always like hearing about the United States going to the moon. You know, for me, it's always like in air quotes, like, did we go? You know, people say, again, did we? You know, but, you know, whether you're a space geek or not, I think this moment is interesting. I think it's even profound about who we are. It says something about the things that we value and the things that we even believe as Catholics. I mean, because let's be honest, humanity has always been drawn upward. I mean, you think about the ancient cathedrals. I think when we used to build churches as Catholics, we used to get it right. I don't think we get it right anymore. Cathedrals were built in, you know, you see them throughout Europe and other places, that they're so enormous that they used to get the theology of littleness correct, that God is completely other than us and that we're looking upward towards God, right? That God is completely other than us, yet he's accessible, right? Because he has his house here. All right, we used to get it in ancient cathedrals, the mystery of littleness. And I think we're the only creatures who look up at night and we look at this big sky and we feel this tug on our soul. We're the only ones who ask the question, like, what's out there? That's us. That's human. And what it means to be human. And this is why I think this story matters. That yes, we do have a desire to long for something out there. We do have a desire to explore. We do have that restlessness, and it's not an accident. It's part of our just human vocation. God made us to seek, to discover, to wonder. So in that seeking, discovering, and wondering, we might find him. And that's why we have that in us, to seek, discover, and wonder. God gave that to us so that we might find him in that seeking, discovering, and wondering. Him who is the source of it all. He hopes that we may arrive there, right? So I think in this way, the church has always taught that creation is a gift that is meant to be known, to be studied, and to be stewarded. So when we see a crew preparing to slingshot around the moon, we're watching a very human expression that God has given us the impulse to reach beyond ourselves so that we might find him, so that in that slingshot, right, we might find him. Well, exploration always comes with questions. Right? This mission of the Artemis II is not cheap. A single launch from the space system, I think it costs around $1 billion, in a whole Artemis space launch system that they're doing, billions of dollars. The program itself, tens of billions of dollars. And so as Catholics, I think we're allowed to ask, like, is this a right and just use of resources? Does it serve the common good? Does it advance human flourishing? And these are not, you know, we can't be accused of these being anti-science questions. They're just the same questions the church has always asked, you know, following every major human endeavor, from medicine to colonialism to the warfare technology. And at the same time, there's something beautiful happening here, right? This mission isn't just an American project. It's international. It's cooperative. It's peaceful. And in a world that right now, I think, is just leaning into conflict, that's addicted to conflict, the idea of nations working together to explore the heavens is a reminder that, yeah, solidarity is possible, especially when we're yearning, seeking, discovering, exploring, right? And so that maybe we might find God together in this seeking and discovering and exploring. In a sense that human beings can collaborate on something other than outrage and division that we see in Minneapolis. And that, too, I think is deeply Catholic, the belief that nations can and should work together for the common good, for the good of all. And then there's the moon itself. The moon has always carried a spiritual meaning for us. It governs the liturgical calendar, it marks the date of Easter, it has long been a symbol of Mary and the church before Mary. The church, you read the fathers, they considered the church as a symbol of the moon. The moon, I'm sorry, is a symbol of the church, because as the moon reflects the light of the sun, so does a church reflect the light of Christ. So when we talk about circling the moon, we're talking about, we're not just talking about like a rock in space. We're talking about a symbol woven into the rhythms of worship and the imagination of the church. But perhaps I think the most important question is this: what does the mission say about us right now in a time when our politics are small, our culture is angry, and our public field, public life feels exhausted, here's a moment when where humanity is doing something right again, something creative again, something ambitious, something that reminds us that, yeah, we're capable of more than shouting at each other. At a time when AI has taken over the job of human creativity and imagination, just the human arduous effort, I think it says that we're still capable of wonder and doing some hard work. And maybe that's the Catholic takeaway on this. Like, we need to wonder. We need beauty. We need moments that lift our eyes up from the chaos. Again, the cathedral. We need moments like this that lift us up beyond to seek something higher. Not just higher altitudes, but higher purpose, higher virtues, higher hopes, higher aspirations. So NASA, as they prepare to send a crew to the moon, I think we should pray for them. Let's pray for their safety. Let's pray for let's pray for the scientists, the engineers who made this possible. And let's pray for the mission, that it rekindles something in us, a sense of awe, a sense of unity, a sense that God's creation is still full of mysteries and is waiting to be discovered. And in the end, in exploration, not just reaching the moon, but it's remembering that we were made for the heavens. And our final top story today, let's turn to the Vatican. And I think on Friday or Saturday, the Holy Doors were sealed, right? So on the January 6th, on the Epiphany, the St. Peter's Basilica, Pope Leo XIV formally sealed the doors to mark the end of the Jubilee of Hope. Every 25 years, a church has its Jubilee. And 2025 was the year of Jubilee of Hope. And then on Friday, the door was sealed, right? So there's a closing of the doors, right, which many people know about. But then there's the sealing, which is even a more profound act. And again, it happens only once every 25 years. Boniam in seculum misericordia eius, mihi adiutores, non tirebo, mihi adiutores. Now this is important. I think the closing of bronze doors and the sealing of the Holy Door, like I said, are two different occasions, right? The Pope closed the door on Epiphany, but actual sealing, the walling up, is done later by Sempertini, the craftsman of St. Peter's Basilica. And according to Vatican News, they built not one, but two walls behind the door. First, a dry wall of 3,200 bricks, each stamped with the Jubilee year. And then a second masonry wall of 620 bricks laid with lime mortar and with a bronze box, as you see, placed inside containing the keys to the door, right? The keys to the door, quite profound. An official closing document, pontifical medals, rosaries, and even gilded bricks that will be removed at the next Jubilee. So this isn't just architecture, it's theology in stone. Why do we do this? Why close the door that millions of pilgrims have just walked through? Well, because the Holy Door is a sign of mercy. A mercy that has a rhythm. It opens, it closes, it returns, it surprises, it humbles. It reminds us that God's mercy isn't just a vending machine. It's not a mechanic, it's not mechanical, it's not predictable. It is, to use a richer word, is ever abounding, is always pouring forth, always radiant, always more generous, more than we expect. And this is where the moon comes back into the story. The moon doesn't always shine at full strength. Sometimes it's silver, sometimes it's half, sometimes it disappears behind a shadow. But it's always there, always reflecting the light of the sun, even when we cannot see it. The church is the same. It reflects the light of Christ, sometimes brilliantly, sometimes faintly, You know, the holy door is a symbol of that. When it opens again, it will show us that the church can be who she can be at her best, a wide, generous, radiant invitation to God's grace. When it's closed and sealed, it shows something equally important, that the church always is also has the capacity to forget, to falter, to become narrow, to become just brick and mortar instead of flesh and mercy. The sealed door is a reminder of our potential for holiness, but also our potential for hardness. And that is why the church does this every 25 years. Every 25 years, we see this same pattern, not because God's mercy stops, it never stops, but because we stop noticing it. We stop seeking it. We stop reflecting on it. The sealed door, I think, is a mirror that's held up to our own souls. The sealed door is asking us, like, are you open to grace? Who have you welcomed in? Are you walled off? I think the millions, I mean, literally millions who came to Rome this past year. Vatican News noted that the pilgrims who passed through the door oftentimes say the same thing, like how moving and how touching the event was for them, how it invoked the perseverance in their faith. And these are people from every nation, every tongue, every walk of life who crossed the threshold. Many of them seeking forgiveness, some of them seeking healing, a lot of them seeking just renewal or hope, some of them seeking their faith again, seeking conversion. Some seeking curiosity, of course. Many non-Catholics will come, Muslims will come, people just come from afar with curiosity, seeking what scientists seek to discover. So yes, the door is closed. Yes, it is sealed, but the mercy symbolizes is not sealed, is ever abounding, is inexhaustible, radiant like the sun reflecting on the moon. And the next time the door opens in 25 years, it will not be because God has changed, his mercy hasn't changed, but because we need to be reminded again of who he is in 25 years. The holy door is not just a door, it's a prophecy in bronze and brick. It tells us who we are and what we can become and what God never ceases to be. This is David L. Gray in the morning. Hey, you ever heard people say that you have to spend money to make money? Well, with my Capital One Quicksilver card, that's exactly what happens. Here's how I use it. I set my monthly budget aside, and then I put everything I'm going to spend on my Quicksilver. Bills, gas, groceries, subscriptions, entertainment, all of it. And if I spend about $3,000 a month, depending upon how much of that is travel, I earn between $45 and $80 in cash back rewards. That's real money for doing nothing extra. And here's the best part. I save all those rewards all year, and I use them for Christmas gifts. That way, I bless my family and friends without spending a single dollar of my own cash, just rewards. The Quicksilver card from Capital One is, I think, simply a smart way to make free money by doing what you already do. Get your card today, tap on the QR code on the screen or the link below in the description. And when the application opens, you'll see my name, David O'Gray, so you know you're in the right place to start earning with your new Quicksilver card. Apply today. Go make some money. What's in your wallet? Let's get to the news headlines.
And here is your January 19th, 2026 briefing from David L. Gray in the morning. Today is Monday, January 19th, and it is Martin Luther King Jr. Day in the United States. Federal offices, banks, post offices, and the stock market are closed for the holiday. Major retailers such as Walmart, Target, Aldi, Costco, Kroger, and Trader Joe's remain open. UPS is closed today while FedEx is operating with modified services. Trash collection is delayed in many cities, and national parks are no longer fee-free on this holiday due to changes implemented for 2026. Internationally, the United Nations continues to warn of deepening humanitarian crises. In Sudan, nearly 3 years of war have pushed the nation into what the UN calls an abyss of unimaginable dimensions. In Gaza, aid agencies say the humanitarian crisis remains severe despite months of ceasefire, calling current relief efforts only a temporary bandage. And at the 80th anniversary of the UN General Assembly, global leaders warned that international cooperation is under strain and urged nations to resist political and economic bullying. In Vatican News, Pope Leo recently urged papal diplomats to be, quote, bridges of hope in a world where goodness often wavers. He also received Prince Albert II of Monaco in a formal audience. And the church continues to reflect on the closing and sealing of the holy door at St. Peter's Basilica, marking the end of the Jubilee of Hope. The saint of the day in our Catholic Church is St. John, Bishop of Ravenna. St. John served his people during the turmoil of the Lombard invasions, and Pope Gregory the Great dedicated his book, The Rule for Pastors, to him. The church also commemorates Saints Marius, Martha, Artifax, and Abacum, martyrs on the Via Cornelia, and Saint Germanicus, a martyr of Philadelphia. This has been Tanya with your January 19th, 2026 briefing from David L. Gray in the morning. I'll be back on Tuesday at this same time for your next update. Thank you.
Thanks, Tanya. Saint John, Bishop of Ravenna, Saints Marius, Martha, Artifax, and Abacum, martyrs of the Via Cornelia, and St. Germanicus, martyr of Philadelphia, pray for us. What about St. John of Ravenna? He lived in a world that was coming apart at the seams. You know, people say that today. Heard someone on my Facebook timeline say, oh, the world is falling apart. I think that's always been the case. People who like live this close to the painting. All right, the painting just always looked rather dramatic when it's right here, right? But you sometimes you have to step away and look at the whole. Wait, this isn't just a painting, there's a mural. I think when you're up and close, it looks rather dramatic. But the Lombard invasions were, yeah, they were tearing through Italy. Political authorities were, it was collapsing. The Roman order was giving away to chaos. Things had changed. Yet in the middle, in all that instability, our saint of the day, John, didn't try to control the moment or bend events to his will. And we'll get into that when I get into my commentary in today's reading. He didn't attempt to manage God or force outcomes. Instead, he stayed rooted in the one thing that he could do, actually govern his own fidelity, his own faithfulness. He cared for his people with a calm that didn't come from circumstances, but from trust. While armies moved and empires shifted, John held fast to the truth that God is not a variable to be manipulated. God is the Lord of history. Even when history seems like it's breaking, John's steadfastness wasn't passivity. It was obedience. It was a conviction that God's purpose unfolds on God's terms, not ours. His timing, not ours. And yet, that's exactly the lesson for us today in today's first reading. The danger of trying to manage God and the freedom that comes when we finally stop trying to do that. Today's readings for the second week in ordinary time, the first readings from 1 Samuel chapter 15, verses 16 to 33. And the gospel reading is from Mark chapter 2, verses 18 through 22. But let's take a look at the first reading today. It begins, Samuel said to Saul. Remember, Saul is the king, Samuel's the prophet. Samuel says to Saul, stop. Let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night. And Saul responded, speak. Samuel then said, through little in your own esteem, are you not the leader of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king of Israel and sent you on a mission saying, go, put this sinful Amalekites under the ban of destruction. Fight them until you have exterminated them. Samuel then asked, why then have you disobeyed the Lord? You have pounced on the spoil, thus displeasing the Lord. Then Saul answered Samuel, saying, I indeed obeyed the Lord. Now notice here this human tendency to reinterpret God. Like God will say this, we'll hear it, and then do some sort of filter of self-interest and vanity. We reinterpret it. He says, I indeed obeyed the Lord, and I fulfilled the mission which the Lord sent me. I brought back Agag. I have destroyed Amalek under the ban. But the spoil? The men took sheep and oxen, the best of what can be banned, to sacrifice to the Lord their God in Gilgag. So rather than destroy everything, somehow Saul thought in his own wisdom, in his own prudence and judgment, that we'll use that as a sacrifice. We'll sacrifice to God something we want to say. God didn't ask for sacrifice, and that's what Samuel says. He says, does the Lord so delight in burnt offerings and sacrifice in obedience to the command of the Lord? Obedience is better than sacrifice, and submission than fat of rams. For a sin like divination is rebellion, and presumption is a crime of adultery. Because you have rejected the command of the Lord, he has too rejected you as a ruler. So let's talk about this for a second. Let's unpack this. So we do have a tendency to be disobedient to God. And we seem to want to be disobedient to God out of our best intentions, we would say, which is strange. Oh, I'll be disobedient, but my intentions were good. That's presumption. That's sin. So it reminds me of a story recently. I've been gone for almost a month. You know, I took a vacation. We went back to the States, did a cruise. We just had a really good time with family and getting to some warm weather. And so I came back. And you know how come when you come back to the chapel, you know, if you're responsible for things, you know, things at the chapel have fallen apart, right? And the person who replaced me from being the coordinator of the Catholic community here is doing an amazing job. But the people who share our chapel, some Protestants who share our chapel, took liberties with the video equipment. And they just did things without asking, right? And so I got back and I said, hey, David, can you come in try to fix with the Protestants, you know, messed up? And I come take a look, right? And so I'm there Sunday, doing the new thing, you know, what we had to work around, we had to do because of what the Protestants messed up. And one of the priests says to me, he says, why are we still live streaming? People should be here in the pews. The only purpose of live streaming was COVID. And of course, you know, I completely agree, you know. But it reminds me. But yeah, that's it. The precept of the church is to come to Mass. There's no precept that says you can watch it on live stream. You can watch it on TV and still fulfill your Sunday obligation. No, the Sunday obligation is that you get your butt in the pews, that you come, that you visit the Lord. That's the precept. Every Sunday and Holy Day of Obligation, there's no workaround to that called live streaming or anything like that. But that's what we justify in our heads, what we're allowed to justify in our minds, you know, from the bishops. Oh, you just stay at home. You know, COVID's dangerous, especially if you didn't get the shot. Stay home, you know, watch it. And so even today, we give that license and we think that's equal. That, oh, I didn't physically go to Mass. I just watched it on live stream. And so really with this, and we sometimes we'll do it in our own lives. We know darn well what God has called us to do in our vocation, as husbands, as fathers, or as just human beings in the community of people. We know who we're supposed to be, right? But because of vanity, because of pride, because of all types of other personal issues and self-interest, we'll reinterpret our calling. We'll reinterpret, we'll justify it, right? We come with this strange moral law in our head that the ends justify the means. No, it's all about the means. The means is where God is at, because he gives us that grace and that capacity to do what we're called to do, how we're supposed to do it, when we're supposed to do it, where we're supposed to do it. But let me wrap this up and say, okay, there's three reasons why this happens, and perhaps this will help you find that peace and joy by doing this self-diagnostic. So there's three reasons why we try to manage God. The first reason is because we don't truly believe that God loves us. We don't. We don't believe he loves us because of just a personal brokenness of our own father. Like understanding that we have a father who loves us may be difficult from people who have father wounds. Or sometimes we just don't understand divine love. Our understanding of love is just human love. And the human love is, well, it's messy, right? And sometimes it doesn't really work to our best interest when people tell us they love us and they do the worst types of things. If that's our understanding of love, then sometimes we will throw that on top of God as some sort of overlay. And we understand God's love through that distorted filter. All right. So because we don't believe that God truly loves us, or that he loves us in some sort of human broken way, that love is going to hurt, then we'll try to manage God's love. We'll try to make his love better. So something that God lovingly offers us, such as a command, we'll say, oh, I can do better. I can offer a better type of love than what you just commanded me to do. Look, God, here it is. So God tells us one thing. We reinterpret it through this broken filter, and we do another thing. That's the first reason why we try to manage God, because we think we can love better than God can love. The second reason why we try to manage God is because we truly don't desire the good, right? We don't desire the true objective good. The good that we desire is a subjective good. And we rank that higher than the objective good, either out of because we don't know it or understand it. We haven't went on that journey of discovery. We haven't went on a slingshot around the moon, right? So we rank it here, the objective good, and we put this subjective good on top of it. Perhaps the subjective good feels better. Maybe in Saul's case, maybe it was making his soldiers feel better. That, oh, go make this sacrifice to the Lord, for he was good to you. Right? We'll put that on top. Right? So that's the second reason. We don't truly desire the objective good. And so because of that, we put our subjective good on top of it. So yeah, and again, we go back to the example. Oh, you need to go to physically go to church to fulfill your Sunday obligation. All right. And then that's the objective good. We'll put a subjective good on top of that. Right. Maybe we don't know the precept. Maybe we think the bishops are still giving us some sort of allowance, you know, since the pandemic. And so we'll put our desire on top of that. Oh, I have this and this and this and this to do. I can do something better. I have a greater good to do on Sunday rather than getting my butt dressed and showered and going to mass, right? We have a greater good than that. And the third reason why we try to manage God and his grace is because we don't believe in hell. We don't believe that there's consequences to being disobedient. We don't think there's consequences for presumption. We don't think there's consequences for desiring the subjective good or the objective good. And we don't think there's consequences to trying to manage the divine. We just don't. If we truly did believe there's consequences, if we truly believe there was hell, then we wouldn't try to manage God. We wouldn't. And we would be we will find out, we will find that management of God is not the calling, rather the calling is to cooperate with God in his grace. Right? That's the safe space. That's that point in the center of the circle of grace. Hey, if you haven't gotten it, check out my book, The Liturgical Sense of the Readings at Mass, where I unpack all the Sunday readings in the Mass, and I put them in context that you can understand. It's easy. It's accessible. Click the call QR code or check the link in the description of, or visit stdominicsmedia.com or wherever you get your books, Amazon, whatever. But in this book is where I walk you through how the readings of Mass are calling you to live them and how you can understand them through the liturgy. So in this case, the liturgy teaches us to cooperate with God. There's nothing about the Mass when it's celebrated rightly, when the priest reads the black in the missal and he does the red, and the faithful do not presume to be priests or bring a bunch of this stuff in the world into the Mass, but rather when the liturgy is celebrated as it ought, then it's teaching us that we ought to cooperate with God as good. This is why in the Mass, we don't say our own words. We say what the church has given us to say. This is why we don't stand, sit, and kneel when we want to, when the church has called us to. Right? That we don't just form a communion line when we want to. We don't receive communion when we want to, but when the church calls us to. Right? That we don't stay in the Mass, whether we obey what the church teaches, that we're dismissed from it to go be in the world who we have become through the liturgy. We don't just stay there because the church is we're cooperating with God and his grace. So everything about the liturgy is about teaching us through a pedagogical way, through repetition, that are calls to cooperation, not divine management. This has been David L. Gray in the morning. I'll be back tomorrow, same time. Thanks for coming in to the first show. We're doing this every day, Monday through Friday. And I hope you like the format, and I will see you tomorrow morning. This is David O'Gray in the morning. God bless.
Hey, you ever...
Wait, I want to do this.
Wake up! It's time to start your day. No better way than rolling with David L. Gray. Wake up! It's praise and morning prayer. Then news and reflection with David L. Gray. Wake up, yeah, rise and shine. Let the joy of the Lord hit your timeline. Wake up, come on, tap like sub and share. It's David L. Gray in the morning with joy in the air.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Let the spirit move you.
Good morning.
David L. Gray.
David
L. Gray in the morning.
Big in the morning.
Joy and
praise all the ways.
All the ways.